Good afternoon, everybody, or good evening, depending upon where you are in the world. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona, and thanks for joining us for another of our virtual events. And today we have our friend James Patterson with us this afternoon. He's going to be talking about the brand new book, Crossdown. Sorry about the glare here. And we do have a stash of signed book plates. So if you order a copy from us, you'll get one of these. I will put a link in the comments field on Facebook and on YouTube. And if you have questions for James, go ahead and put them in. And Barbara will bring me on screen towards the end of the hour, and I will be happy to ask any questions you might have. So Barbara, over to you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Jim, it's a real pleasure to see you again. So
yeah, nice to see you.
A moment of dueling Edgars here, because James Patterson, if I can remind you, won the Edgar for his very first Alex Cross book. Want to hold up Mr. Poe and Dazzles?
Yeah, there he is.
Love
hey,
it.
He's dancing. Look, he's so happy. Woo! Mr. Bill. Mr. Edgar.
Well, I mean, that's a terrific start to win the major prize from the Mystery Writers of America in your very first novel.
Oh, it was a great thrill. It was great. I was 26. I could write back then. And, totally unexpected. They couldn't find me. And they finally got through to me. And the woman said, I'm Mystery Writers of America, and you've been nominated for an Edgar, and you have to come. And I said, well, when is it? She said, Saturday night. And I said, I can't go. I'm sorry. Something was coming up, and I couldn't. I think I had to work or something. And and she said, no, you've been nominated. You have to come. And I said, oh, no, I heard you, but I can't come. And she said, well, you won. And I said, all right, I'm going to find a way to come. and I did win, but I'll tell you what, I brought my mom and dad, which was cool. And it was at the old Commodore Hotel. I don't know if it's still there or not.
Where is
and,
that?
In New York City.
No, I know, but we're in New York City. I've never
it's, even it's in the 40s. Yeah. It's near Grand Central. It's a little north of Grand Central. And, when I got there, I was sitting there, and she'd already told me I won, but I was going, what if she lied to me? So I still had that tension of maybe she lied, And then, as I told you before, Robert Parker, I won Best First Novel, and Robert Parker won Best Novel that night. And that was very cool. And we were getting our picture taken together. And I'd read all of his books, and all of a sudden I blanked on the name of the lead character. And he looks at me, he goes, Spencer, like the poet, which is a line he used to use in all the early books. And I was so embarrassed, so it was fine.
He was a great guy. I was very, very happy that MWA made him a Grand Master right before he died. And he was here, Jim, that March, because he would come out here. And that particular night in March of the year that he'd just been named the Grand Master. Now, normally, Bob was like 20 minutes was the best you could get from Bob. He didn't love doing, talks. An hour and a half elapses while we're going.
Wow,
and finally, I said to him, like with a hook, I said,
don't you have to go to dinner or something, Bob?
Well, I did say to him, Bob, maybe we should stop and sign books. The next day when Putnam asked me, how it had gone, I said, an hour and a half in, I had to hook him off stage because he was saying to everybody, you can call me Grandmaster Bob. I mean, he just loved it. And Putnam wrote back and they said, you must have had some other Robert B. Parker at the store, because it was so he just loved that. We lost
him. Yeah, well, as you know, I do with Mike Lupica now do books. And as a matter of fact, the one that's coming in September, I think is the best character that we've ever done, which is it's called 12 Months to Live. And it's really... it's easy. I think I can be objective about this stuff. I can certainly look at the ones and go, this one isn't as good. But 12 Months to Live is really cool. At any rate, but Mike took over the Spencer series now. So the first one is coming somewhere in the fall. I think he'll do a really good job.
I think he did a wonderful job with the two he's already done. I love his Sonny Randall, and I think he's done an excellent job with Jesse Stone. And
I thought the Sonny Randalls were better than Parker's. I thought he got Sonny better than Parker did. He's not going to do the Sonny anymore, though. He's done with Sonny.
No, he's handed it over to Allison Galen, who will be here to talk about it. Mike has that same gift for dialogue and really snappy humor that Bob had.
Yeah. You know, he's Yeah, not in real life, though. He's really kind of boring as a person, but, you know, no, I'm kidding. No, we get along great. We talk every day. I talked to him tonight before this. He said, say hello to Barbara.
Well, I'm sorry he's not joining us. He's a lot of fun, and we're going to
We will, and whenever we're doing 12 Months to Live, we'll come and visit.
Well, that will be great. Now, we're going to hear to talk about Crosstown, but I do want to preface this. Jim was kind enough in the 23rd midnight to mention three bookstores, two bookstores that are like legendary, and then the Poison Pen. And I thought we were going to get a paragraph or maybe even a sentence, but we actually got a chapter, chapter 56. And I wanted to say that I am described in this as wearing red with a short blonde bob. Now, I forgot that before we started this. So I have gone to my wardrobe at the last second and I have pulled out red. So I can match the 23rd midnight.
All right. Okay.
But thank you, Jim. And
that's a good look for you, the red.
Thank you. I like it very much. And I also did a little thank you to you, and through Shelf Awareness, I reminded everybody that because you are so incredibly supportive of independent bookstores and so philanthropic to booksellers and all, that we were in the first round of grants that you made to bookstores. Lord knows how long ago that was. Might have been 20 years ago.
I don't know. I try to think forward, not too much backwards, but it was a while.
It was a long time ago, but it was certainly very welcome. And I think everybody in the book community is so grateful to you for, you know, giving back the way you did.
Well, you know, it's just the way I was brought up. I have to give all the praise to my mother and grandmother. That was just their deal. I'm on automatic in terms of whatever we can do for whatever. It's teachers, getting kids reading, giving books away to kids, and indie bookstores.
Well, you do a magnificent job, that is for sure. And you've been honored for it, but I don't think you do it for the glory. I think you do it because it's...
No, I do it for the glory.
You like the glory, too?
Yeah, I love it. One of the ones we have now, I think we're the biggest benefactor, the Iowa School for Writers. That's a fun one, too, because I get to read all their stories, and every couple of months they send me all the new stuff, which is fun.
I bet it's fun. I remember our conversation, you and Bill Clinton, that Lee Child guest hosted. For that, we did the launch for that. And that was actually, that's the one time when I think that Bill had the most FaceTime of everybody, or at least the most talking time, didn't he? President Clinton.
He should. Yeah, absolutely.
I thought so too. Really interesting story. So we're here to talk about Crosstown, which is hugely entertaining and as always with Jim, a propulsive read and a fast read, but there's some really serious issues that come up in it. And depending on whether Jim wants to get a little serious, we can do that. But there's a co-author involved here called Brendan Dubois, who some of you may remember, especially Poison Pen customers, wrote a number of books set along coastal New Hampshire. So, Jim, tell us a bit about Brendan. Why is he?
I don't really know much about him. He's kind of a boring guy, lives out in the New Hampshire. Yeah. Brendan is great. What happened is, this is actually kind of a funny story. When I was doing the book shots, which were these 90 novellas, which I thought was a useful thing for people to have, where they could come in and they could read a novella in whatever it's going to take, an hour and a half or 2 hours. And it's like going to the movies. I thought for some people that would be useful. I thought it'd be useful for bookstores to, you know, people who go, I don't really, at this stage in my life, I don't have 5-6 hours, but, you know, at any rate, but I did, during those days, I was doing three a month. And I needed co-writers desperately. And, you know, people couldn't, they didn't know where to find co-writers. So what I did was I went and I picked up the best mystery short stories of the year. And I kept going through them, and I would find different people. And Brendan had written something, a short story, or a little more than a short story, called The End, I think it was. And I thought it was great. And what I'm always looking for are people who can write scenes. I can lay out the plot and I'll do an outline that might be 60 or 70 pages. And then if it's going to be a co-writer, I want somebody who can write the scenes and make them work. And I read the end and I went, this is really cool. So I made a phone call and I get Brendan on the line and I go, this is James Patterson. And he goes, the author. And he's like, what are you talking about? Blah, 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 blah. I said, no. The police don't hang up. And he didn't. I actually had one of the people I called hung up. I had to call him again, but Brendan didn't. And we started chatting and I asked him if he'd be, actually what I think what we did the first one is the end starts with a guy you don't really know where you assume he might be with CIA, but you know he was doing some tough stuff and now he's kind of retired on a lake in New Hampshire. And some stuff happens on the lake and it irritates him and he, you know. And I said, well, what if we, he said he owned the rights to the end. I said, great. Let's write a prequel to it and we'll make it a novella and we can deal with what drove him to retire on the lake. So we thought through and plotted out, you know, what the beginning of the, before the end. and then he did a great job. And I think we did another book shot after that. And now we've done a few. We did the Amy Cornwall, a couple of those, which I thought turned out real well. And now Crosstown, it's your Alice Cross for the summer, so you can have Cross in the summer for a change. And I've said this before, but you hope that they're all going to turn out well, but they don't, and some aren't as good as others. But this one turned out really well. I think it's really really readable, and a lot goes on it. And as you say, there are some serious subjects. Something happens to Alex, and I'm not going to get into whether Alex survives or not, but something happens to him, so it is crossed down. And so it becomes to some extent Samson's book after a while. Mm-hmm. And he does great. You know, it's interesting. We just at Amazon, we just finished shooting 8 episodes of Cross for Amazon. And I'll get the name wrong, I think, but they just the guy who's playing Samson, who's great, is I think his name is Isaiah Mustafa, and he's actually the guy who does the Old Spice commercials, and he's wonderful. And initially, when they brought him in for they were a little scared of using him. And they said, "Well, everybody will think it's the Old Spice guy." I said, "I don't care. This guy is great, and you can't hold that against him. He's a really good actor, and he is, and he's physical, and he's and he's large. He was a football player, I think, at Arizona State. I'm not sure about that one, but I think it was Arizona State. And he's really good. So he's Samson in the TV series or the streamer.
I really like Samson in the book. He's the first person narrator in the book.
Yeah,
for a variety of reasons. And I think you describe him as being like 6'9", because he does occasionally, his size is an issue for him.
Yeah, he won't be that big in the TV series, but he's big.
I really like him. And it's a way you've got in this book, you've got Samson from the Metro PD, and then you've got, what's his name from the FBI? His name, like Ned, whatever.
Ned Mahoney.
Right.
Ned Mahoney's my best friend from college.
Is he?
So now he's famous or infamous or whatever. Yeah.
Does he actually work at the FBI or is that just
a teacher? Teacher, his whole life. You know, I do that series. I don't know how much you deal with those in the store, but it's a really good series. The Walk in My Combat Boots, mm-hmm. and ER Nurses. And then we did Walk the Blue Line. And so we're doing a teacher's one now. So we do interviews and then we turn the interviews into these 5 or 6 page whatevers. And we're going to do Ned Mahoney and his wife, both were teachers. So they're going to get interviewed for the book. So that'll be fun. And Ned has a little chip on his shoulder. So he'll be perfect for this, Ned Mahoney, in real life.
I don't know how you have time to manage all this stuff. Do you have flow charts?
You know, it's funny. I a friend of mine, President Clinton's, was chief of staff, Tina Flournoy, and she then became Kamala Kamala is chief of staff. I'm blanking. Vice President Kamala. And
Harris, right.
Biden, you know, takes a lot of, and that's a perfect lead in that mistake, because Biden will take a lot of heat because, I can't remember when my daughter is three or two, momentarily kids or stuff like that. And I will do that. And I just did it with Kamala's last name. But in terms of the book stuff, I find that I'm sharper than I've ever been in terms of whatever I do. And I think a little bit of that was writing the autobiography. It really got me into the writing more than I have in a while and into every sentence and, you know, really, really being painstaking about the writing. And I think it made me better, which is really cool at this stage. And I am as excited about this as I've ever been, which is a blessing for me.
It's absolutely amazing. I've never been entirely clear, you know, how much you obviously have a big editorial role, you know, because you have all.
No. If you came to my office, it would blow your mind. You know, if you work with me, you go, holy shit. This is not editorial. I've told you this before, but there are, 34 manuscripts around. You can't really see them because it's facing the other way. And they're all alive, including the Hollywood stuff. Hollywood stuff, I get the scripts, I'm back that same day. I do what I have to do. In some cases, it's the outlines. In some cases, it's major writing. In some cases, it's rewriting. And whatever their sickness is, it won't go away. But people get this idea because they project their own life or their own abilities onto this thing. I ain't you, and I'm not. And it's a weird thing that I do, but it's a lot more than people think it is. And anybody that comes to the office goes, I remember we had this one journalist here, and this was during book shots, and he kept going, this is crazy. And then he said, James, you are crazy. And whatever it is, that's what it is. And I think there are some, I think King is a little this way, same way, really, really, really obsessive, compulsive in a good way. And that's just the way I am. And I love doing it, but I'm not, you know, people have this idea, like I'm not involved. I'm crazy involved. You know, I'm finishing right now, which is a really cool project. I'm finishing a Michael Crichton novel. He had written 70 pages and his estate came and they said, do you want to do it? I said, well, let me read the 70 pages. And I loved them. Some of the later stuff I wasn't as keen on. That's why I definitely wanted to read the pages. And it's, we've talked about it. So it's not, there's a volcano on the island of Hawaii threatening to just destroy that island. That's cool. But there's something even more destructive on the island, which nobody knows about. And it's a world destroyer. I mean, it's just something huge. And I said, yeah, I want to try to do this. And the real challenge was his work has a lot of science in it, and yet he keeps it moving along. So that was the trick, how to really put a lot of stuff that might show up in nonfiction into the book while keeping the pace going. It's almost done now. And it's really exciting. It was a great project. It really got me pumped about doing it, you know.
I never thought you weren't involved. I couldn't work out how you managed to both write and keep track of all the various projects. So you don't even have a project manager? It's all you?
Yeah. 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 No, this is it. There's the office. Here's whatever it is. And I'll talk to the co-writers minimum once every 2 weeks. Lupica, I talk to every day. Some of them I talk to a fair amount. Brendan, I'll talk to a fair amount. Brendan's probably once a week kind of thing with Brendan. And no project manager, no whatever it is, it is. And you know, I think the books come to Little Brown pretty clean. And I have a real good two editors at Little Brown, and they're workaholics too, so it's perfect. The lovely Denise, who she's incredible. And then some of it is very, I also just signed up to do, which is an interesting one, the Idaho murders.
Ah, boy.
I'm doing that with Vicki Ward. Ward, we worked together a bit on the documentary that was on Netflix on Epstein. And then we did worked out a little bit together on a podcast on Ghislaine. And now we're going to do the Idaho thing. We'll both be there for the trial, which I think is going to be in late September, early October. Well, it's planned that way for the moment. We'll see. Yeah, and that's an interesting project too.
It would be. That trial came up yesterday talking to Megan Abbott, who did an event with us at the store. And we were talking about how difficult it would have been to ever convict him before forensic evidence was, you know, came into play. You know, it sort of spiraled up from other things. And Riley Sager has a book about foundationally Lizzie Borden, for example. And today, you know, I think there would be resolution in the Lizzie Borden story, but back then. You know, it's fascinating the way all this goes. And I think, you know, the
artificial thing is, intelligence, they'll be able to convict you instantly, right on the spot.
Well, you know, juries have been conditioned, though, by television all to believe in forensic evidence, sometimes to the detriment of what goes on. But I mean, we'll skip over the O.J. Simpson trial. But most of the time today, I think we can assume that, you know, much of the time, by the time it gets to trial, that a conviction is fairly likely because.
Well, if you say that, you will never get any juries. All you have to do is say that to the judge and you will be dismissed.
I've never been allowed to sit on a jury.
Uh-huh. Well, that right there will do it.
I know. That's okay. I spend my time.
I think if it gets this far, the person is guilty. See ya.
Right. So I want to go back to In Crosstown. As I said, it's a terrific read. It really moves fast. There is a ton of action in this book. I mean, cinematic. I mean, you can just see it, you know, unfolding. But I love on page 15, I love this line in which you say, because we're having a meeting in the White House with the president and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And you say, I love this. I learned a long time ago that presidents are like most men and women, and as politicians, they will always break your heart. Wow. What do you mean by that?
It's just the reality. I mean, other than my friend, President Clinton. There's so many secrets that they have. There's so many things they can't say. They always have the greater good as their, well, I had to do it for the greater good. So it puts you in a strange position with the truth, which, as you can see now, is a continuing. We've never had situations like we have now in terms of truth and lies, and you know.
I know, and it's only
Comey has a book out. That's interesting.
Who does?
Comey. I mean, that's a fascinating. Yeah. I don't know if you. Apparently, it sounds like the publisher didn't print enough because it seems to be in short supply, but whatever.
It is the book in which, you know, I think the basic plot idea is a good one. I would have expected a lot more stuff from his career.
That FBI stuff. Okay.
It's pretty standard rather than, you know.
All right. That's too bad.
Like have more insider stuff. But that was another thing I wanted to mention, that with Crosstown, it's pretty clear. A, there's some big jurisdictional questions among all the different departments and people that are part of the action in Crosstown. Yeah. But a lot of this is basically White House protocol and all. Did President Clinton, you know, kind of, are you familiar with that from your work with President
Clinton? Some of it. And he helps. He'll help out a little bit and or give me somebody to talk to. Which is useful because he has, you know, obviously a lot of contacts. And the jurisdictional dispute thing, I mean, that one of the reasons that I wanted Alex to be in Washington originally was because of that. There's so much, you know, with the FBI and the CIA and the DEA and, well, when I started, there wasn't Homeland Security. There's so many things that can happen there. I always get a kick out of some of these, like, you know, box out there and his whatever. And pretty soon he'll have killed everyone. And you know what I mean? It's like you kind of run out of victims in some of these towns. Who's the writer in New Mexico at the small town there, famous mystery series? Same thing there.
In New Mexico.
Yeah. Famous series. I'm so bad with the names. But I always worried. I mean, like, pretty much everybody in town is dead by now. So, but in Washington, you have so many possibilities. And you do run into this jurisdictional stuff. And it's fun, even if it's just the FBI and the local police. That's enough to have fun with.
Well, it is. But, I mean, it can really impede, what needs to be done if people are,
It shouldn't, but it does. Yeah.
Well, conflict is the stuff of thrillers, so the more conflict you have, the more thrilling it can get.
Well, who's that one guy supposed to teach you how to write? And he said, you can't write anything. Conflict is the key to suspense. No conflict, no suspense.
I'm not sure. I did have a quote that I was going to throw at you from Saturday Night Joe Nesbø, whose name I can't pronounce in Norwegian, but he was born in Brooklyn. So he said it was okay just to call him Joe. But he said that all novels, I think he was really thinking crime novels, are political, which I thought was an interesting statement.
A lot of people right now think that everything's political. So, in theory, you could say, you can make a case that there is. I mean, certainly it's the way people look at things now, unfortunately. I wish people could get off their islands a little bit. And like a lot of people, I'm not going to get into heavy, but I've been driven to be an independent. It's just hard to, I agree with certain things. I don't agree with certain things. I mean, not to get into hot water here, but, pro-choice, but I totally get the other side. If people are being honest about it, I get it. You're Catholic, you have a belief. I get that. I understand it, and I can respect it. And I also respect the other side. So some of the things they're complicated. And I wish, even the thing about government, to me, rather than demonizing people, which drives me crazy, is, look, the big conflict is big government, small government. That's really all it is. And, and there's validity on both sides of it. And just argue that. You don't have to, someone doesn't have to be a bad person because they want small government. They don't have to be a bad person because they want big government. They just have a belief system. And,
I know what's difficult is when you begin to police people's private lives, but let's go back to Plato. Come on.
He said,
who shall govern the governors? And really that's, that question is at the heart of Crosstown, if you think about it.
It is. Yes. Right. Yeah. Well, and more and more now, we're certainly drifting, and maybe we never went away, but an era with, I don't think we've ever identified so many despots around the world. Yeah. And the potential here has never been greater for people to get in who just think that what they believe and how they want to act is more important than the way the government is set up.
Well, what it means is there's much more personal loyalty than there is, countryside loyalty. But we also have oligarchs, there's no question that, in the U.S., I think that, maybe the tech industry really is what kicked it into gear. But, that kind of money, that kind of power. Very oligarchy to me. So, we're all kind of drifting somewhat. Every time there is too big a division between the very rich and the very poor, you wind up with something like the French Revolution, which started out to be.
Well, except that, remember, in France, the poor were really poor.
Really poor.
Some people are. But, but Crosstown, you're right. I mean, we do have that, the larger issue of, people getting terribly, terribly angry and feeling that the government isn't for them anymore. I mean, and that's a big part of what Crosstown's about. People deciding that the government is just all wrong. It can't operate that much. And take what happened on January 6th, whether you whatever you believe about it, and multiply it. And we have crossed out in terms of what's happening in that book, where some people just and it's a world now where so many people, they have nothing that they really believe. They don't believe in a government. They don't believe in religion. They don't believe in family. They don't, so it becomes difficult for people like that. At any rate, so that's a little bit of what's happening in Crosstown and what Santa gets thrown into. Because not only doesn't have his partner at his side, because Alex is in the hospital. I'll let you know that much. And Samson has to track down a lot of this himself, including going back to Asia where he served in the military. And we hadn't really gotten that much about that from Samson. And he does meet up with a woman from the CIA who he was close to in the book. So that's an interesting thing as well in terms of, you know, what's going to happen there. And clearly they were close at one time. And eventually we have to go back and deal with this series of revolutionary activities, things that are happening in the States.
Well, Alex stays healthy, I mean, before he gets hurt, long enough to give Samson a clue, because what's we can say, starting out, that there have been a number of apparently unrelated disastrous incidents, school children being shot at and, you know, car bombing and that kind of thing. And it all looks random. But Alex thinks that maybe there might be some kind
there's
of
a link, yeah,
pattern to it.
That Alex, man, he can figure stuff out like nobody.
Yeah, you know, but I mean, that's really kind of the key.
Well, that's fun. I know. It is. Yeah.
You can take it. So I'm going to go all the way back to civics. When I was young, we had to read the Constitution and study civics. And then as a political science major at Stanford, I got to do it all over again. And the thing we all had to read were the Federalist Papers, which, for those of you who don't know, were 10 papers to argue to the young America representatives and so forth about why we should adopt the Constitution that replaced the Articles of Confederation. And the key one that nobody ever pays attention to, but it's the key, is Federalist Paper number 10, in which James Madison specifically argues that our kind of government cannot hold if there is a tyranny of minorities. Meaning, if there isn't enough broad consensus, if there are too many minority groups and so forth, that the center can't hold and the system can't hold. And that's where we are. We are in Federalist Paper number 10 in your book.
We're close enough for sure. Yeah. Hopefully we won't quite get, you know, we'll see where it goes. I hope people start pulling together in instead book. Of falling apart. Yeah. No, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I thought.
It's amazing how insightful some of the founders were. Mm-hmm. And it was just a different way of looking at things and the depth, which nobody has time for now, which is unfortunate.
Right. Well, and there were things they didn't envision. I mean, it wouldn't have occurred to them. People didn't live that long, or very rarely. It wouldn't have occurred to them that you could have, you know, people in government in their 90s. What's his name?
Or AK-47s, for example.
That too. Yeah.
They might have had a couple little things on the Second Amendment that have said, no AK-47s. We don't want those in the hands of the farmers.
Well, you know, the genius of the Constitution, but the problem of the Constitution is that it is general enough and vague enough that it has been, it mutates with society. But the difficulty is pinning it down in different areas. Like, what does the First Amendment really mean at the moment? What does the Second Amendment mean? Do we have a right to bear arms? Do we have a right to kill each other? Or it was really intended as a means of self-defense when, you know.
And we don't like change, and we don't, I mean, you know, I always get a kick out of, you know, when early on with the automobiles, and people did not want stoplights and stop signs. And how dare you, you know, imagine a world with no stoplights and stop signs, et cetera, et cetera.
We have a whole thing here against speed cameras. I mean, we just had it happen again where people keep putting up bills, you know, to ban speed cameras, but there's really no other particular way to pay attention to what happens on the freeways. You know, if we were in Britain, I don't know whether you watch any British cop shows or read a lot of British crime, but I'm telling you, the first thing that happens every single time is they call for the CCTV. They want to see the footage on the streets, on the buildings and all. I mean, privacy, as anybody knew it, in a lot of places is largely gone. You know, you are under observation constantly.
You talk about these funny things happening. I during COVID, it's continuing. I've become like a Dick Wolf fanatic, and watching all of the various law and orders, all the different whatevers, and some are better than others, and the FBI even, which I had avoided for a long time, and Chicago, whatever. But the hilarious thing is, in almost every show, and it's almost like, how was it? There was that show about the underwater guy, and around 10 minutes into every show, he would go, and then it happened, you know? And all of Wolf shows, at some point they will see somebody and they'll go, Barbara Peters, FBI, and the person takes off and they have a chase. Every show, they will never like get close to the person like where they could actually grab them. They're like half a block away. They'll go, Barbara Peters, FBI. And immediately the person takes off and they chase the person. Every single show. It's very funny, you know.
It is. The other thing, I think we watch a lot of European, particularly French crime shows. There's not one that goes by, Jim, where they don't unleash the SWAT team. I mean, you know, guys in body armor, and they said like 40 guys.
Oh, no, that's in all of them, too. All SWAT. Oh. Yeah, we better get SWAT. Yeah.
It really is. So back to Crosstown. I love John Sampson. I think he is a terrific, you know, first person point of view character in this book. And he does keep the family stuff alive. He keeps the children alive. He reminds us about his, departed wife. We see Alex's wife.
Ree has Willow, his girl. Wife. Yeah.
Yep. So, I mean, it is, there's a lot of relationship in it, but it really does spring in part from the January 6th, imagining if you took the January 6th up considerable notch and how many people you could bring into it. And I think, you know, you trust no one. I mean, that's a mantra that we've all heard forever. But in this book, trust no one really is the thing. Who in the world can anybody trust, including Sampson, other than Alex? I mean, I think there's never a question that Alex and Sampson can trust each other. But
you can trust Nana Mama. You can trust Nana Mama.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. No, I meant the action.
No, I know. I know. Right. No, absolutely. And that's part of, look, I mean, this isn't realism, but that's part of what makes it fun. That's part of what makes it fun. The trust no one thing, that kind of, you know, paranoid in a fun way, you know, but there is a feeling that way. I think a lot of people, I'm not trust no one, but there definitely is a lot not to trust in the world. And, you know, on the, unfortunately, that not trusting the government, and taking it to extremes is really a big problem. The big problem. And that's why the book, while not being realistic, it rings true in certain, you know, in terms of our nightmares.
It's actually becoming more and more the case in military thrillers and that the bad guys turn out to be us, you know, instead of like the forces over there in the sandbox or something. The real problem is going to be some corrupt guy back in, you know, Congress or the CIA or occasionally. Baldacci, I think, was the first one, Jim, you might remember this better, but I think in Absolute Power, he was the very first to make the actual president of the United States the bad actor.
The villain.
He was a serial rapist and a murderer. And that created, you know, a huge story.
Well, we had the Richard Condon. We've had a couple of crazy presidents along the way before. But Baldacci. That's a wonderful scene. Wonderful way to get into what he did in the beginning of that book. I won't spoil it for the 10 people who haven't read it or watched it.
It's so old, I thought we could safely say that. But increasingly, I am finding, as I say, for some weird reason, we've become kind of an epicenter for military fiction, which you wouldn't think would be the case of an 82-year-old small blonde wearing red, but that's how it is. I think it's partly the Clive Cussler effect. It began to attract, you know, people. So I spent a lot of time with guys writing military fiction, and I'm very impressed with some of their insights. You will like this one, I think. Two guys that are going to take over the Tom Clancy Senior series, Brian Wilson and his colleague. We were talking about Russia, and they pointed out, they've all served and all, that the goal for Russia is not winning. The goal for Russia is to make you lose. And if they can make you lose, therefore they win. And I'd never really thought about it that way before. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you... it's not a win-win. It's a it's a you lose, we win situation. And that's not how we think about, you know, things. So I'm finding their insights are great, but I'm also finding increasingly, as I say, that the real enemy is us. It's not the foreign, the foreign guys are out there, but the
I think we have, unfortunately, I think it rings true. There are bad people everywhere. And they're here as well, obviously. But you know, yeah, there are some bad folks in Russia. There are some bad, you know, it's just and that's why on some level, you know, we have to keep our military and keep it strong, because there are, and people are naive when they pretend like there's nobody out there who's bad. No, there are. There are a lot of good people out there, but unfortunately, and they tend to be men.
Well, we have a tendency in this country to grow complacent. You know, I'm not quite old enough to remember Robert La Follette and the whole, you know, after World War I, and how hard it was for Roosevelt to drag us into World War II as a consequence. But it is easy in times of peace to think it's always going to be peaceful and you can let your guard down. But, you know, obviously that's not working. Anyway, back to the other thing I will say is that I was led down, I think, intentionally, a garden path in this book, because I was pretty sure that I knew who the real bad actor in this book was, and it turned out I was wrong. So I like that. There was some really nice misdirection, I think, about how this eventually is going to play out.
Yeah, well, that's always one of the only trick with misdirection sometimes, if, as you know, Barbara, if people think they figured it out halfway through, you're kind of dead. If they really go, okay, I know where this is going, and I can sort of plot it out in my head, and you know, whatever, that's the end of the book. And a lot of writers don't seem to understand that. And it's not going to, you're not going to be forgiven if, you know, 130 pages later, oh, it wasn't what I thought, because I went through 130 boring pages because I thought I had figured it out and I thought I knew where it was going. And that's a big part of the fun of suspense. You know, questions. I know you know this. Questions you must have answered. Yeah, that's the thing about somebody like John Grisham, who's not one for the big everything's got a lot of page turning and you know. But he sets the hook. He's great at setting a hook very early, and you must have the answer. And you know, he'll go at it in certainly a different way than I do, but you must have the answer. And that setting the hook is such, that's, it's just crucial. But if people think they know the answer, you're dead in the water. If they think they figured it out, I know where this goes, blah, 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 blah. And then, yeah, no.
Or sometimes you wonder if the author can really bring it off. Have you ever read Stephen Hunter's The 47th Samurai?
I have read a bunch of his, but not that one, no.
Well, I don't want to spoil it for you, but I really urge you to read it because, as you know, Bob Lee and Earl, they're gun guys, right? And they're going up against a sword guy. They're going up against a Japanese.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
And, you know, the question is,
don't bring a sword to a gunfight.
Well, I think it was a
special
really,
sword. Yeah.
Really very clever way of handling
Sanford's new book with Letty is interesting. In that I don't know what his deal is, but I think he was taking some heat about Davenport, and for whatever reason he decided he was going to write this book about the daughter or the adopted daughter, and she's now more vicious than he ever was. And she has this, which I'm fine. I like Davenport and I like Letty too. But you talk about guns, man. She's a gun person in a stunning, I mean, it's just a kind of amazing. I'm not a gun person, but I got done reading it and I said, like, well, maybe I'll get a gun collection. Not really. But I mean, it was just so like, wow, you know, the toys.
I agree. Now, but yeah. Letty was tough. If you go all the way back to Letty's origin story, Letty was
She's
going to blend in with Virgil, and you know, because Virgil is a younger.
I love Virgil. Virgil to me is he's my favorite of. Why am I sitting here selling his books? He never does anything
for
me.
Talk about other authors. Come on.
No, I agree. I agree. No, he's good. He's very good.
But maybe this is a moment to bring Patrick back and see if there are questions from sure. the audience that Patrick can address, or maybe there's something else Patrick would like to address.
Okay. Howdy. Yeah, there are some questions here. Let's see here. One of them is, are there any subjects or topics that you will not write about that are kind of off limits?
You don't want to, do terrible things to children if you can help, things I won't write about, not because they're off limits, but I won't write really too much about generals because I don't really understand how they talk and think. I do some in Cross Down, but not too much. And I will never write romances. I can write love stories, but not romances. I don't mean to put them down, but I don't really understand them. In terms of off limits, though, I don't know. I've done a lot of off limit writing. So for some people, anyway. So yeah. That's all I got for that.
Will there be any more Ally Cross?
That's a good question. You know, the children's area is just so tough now. It just becomes hard because people won't stock the books, even me. I mean, it's a nutty, especially that age group. They stock young adult. And the reason what they don't, the reality of it is a lot of young adult books are bought by adults, right, which is why they sell better. And the kids' books, for whatever reason, people are just not buying them for the most part. So it's just tough. And then also it's infected with, people calling in from outside and go, oh, you shouldn't do that or that line, or this is wrong for kids and blah, 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 blah. So I don't like that. It's so restrictive now that it becomes hard. So the answer is kind of maybe, but I don't know. They've driven me away from the kids' books a little bit because, I mean, once again, I just think a lot, kids are fine. They go on the internet. You're not going to hurt their feeling. You're not going to, they're okay. They can handle a mystery or, I don't know. So we'll see about Ally. But I like Ally will continue to be in the adult books.
Is there kind of a difference in your mind of writing for middle grade readers versus teens? Is one easier than another?
I like them both. I prefer on some level writing for middle level, right, because I, for the most part, not Ally, but most of the other things I did for middle grade, they're comedic, which I really enjoy. So I'm funny and middle school, the worst years of my life. My favorite is still Potty Mouth and Stupid, which a lot of adults, gatekeepers, say, oh, it's got stupid in the title. Yes, because it's about word bullying, which to me is more dangerous than physical, not dangerous, but more prevalent certainly than physical bullying. And it's a really, I think it's a really fun book and really funny and really true to life. And, but once again, the gatekeepers are okay if they're doing a good job with the gates and bad if they're, we have it now, Maximum Ride was banned in a county in Florida. I'm going like, what? How can you ban Maximum Ride? That's like banning all the Marvel movies. Only Maximum Ride is more innocent than the Marvel. 30 million kids have read those books. And it's banned because one person comes in and they say it's inappropriate for grade school kids. And the person had never read any. So what is that? But then it actually gets banned. That's like nuts. Maybe Roberts, what's her name? The romance. I don't want to.
Nora.
Nora was banned. What? what is that? That's banned. There are probably a couple books that should be banned. How to Become a Nazi at Six or whatever. I mean, there are books that, we go, I don't really want, it should be the exception, not the rule. And it shouldn't be where one person comes in and they just declare this thing is inappropriate. And that's like crazy. Yeah.
It's a really badly drafted law. And, unfortunately,
it's exactly right. Yeah. It is badly drafted. It's much too vague. And it should be something where, yes, schools have some ability to protect the kids, but not enough so that it's ridiculous.
And unfortunately, the flash mobs that social media allow are pretty terrifying. So, you know, I think
it didn't even take a flash mob for these.
No, and they banned some. But you know, other instances, we got caught in one once through, you know, just staying loyal to a friend. And it's really awful when it happens to you. You just have to power through it and recognize that, you know, it'll go away. It's just that for that moment when it's happening, it can be very unnerving.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I've been through it one time. Yeah.
Too bad. But
it used to be the province of the far right, you know, but now it's equally the left.
Yeah. Well, that's when I mentioned this teacher's book that I'm writing, and the poor teachers are getting it from every side.
Yes, they are.
In terms of, it's just so, so hard for them
and
to do their jobs.
Not just teachers. Yeah.
Librarians. I have I think you'll get a kick out of this. I don't know if you're aware of it. I have a book coming out in April in that series of Welcome to Comic Boots and stuff like that. And it's The Secret Lives of Booksellers and Librarians. It's a comedic title, and it's the same thing. It's just the stories of books, a lot of booksellers and librarians.
Do we get to feature in it again?
I don't think so this time, but we are. But it's fun. It's really fun. And it's a really neat cover. I must say, this was, because you get afraid, people are going, will that be interesting? The original title was like, Walk Am I, whatever. I said, no, this needs a title that's more, that's got a wink in it. And the cover does. So people don't think, well, it's going to be stuffy and boring, you know, whatever, like libraries. And it is, it's a lot of fun. And so that'll be a fun book in April.
So when Jim, when you're writing nonfiction, so to speak, do you use the same? I think narrative nonfiction is such an interesting term that we hear. And my definition of narrative nonfiction is that you take real stuff, but you tell it like a story, you know, with the same impetus.
Yeah, that's exactly what I try to do. That's what I did with Lenin and even Epstein, but Lenin in particular, the John Last Days of. And we'll certainly try to do that with Idaho, within reason, to make it scenes. And I remember way back with Norman Mailer, Armies of the Night, and he took a lot of criticism because he there were real things, but he created a lot of dialogue, and he took a lot of heat for that. And he just said, the dialogue is directionally correct. And that's all. And, you know, whatever, read it and you can make up your own mind about how you feel about it. And I kind of like that approach. So I want, you know, a lot of nonfiction is not very good storytelling for me. And some of it is. I just finished The Wager, and that's he's a good nonfiction.
Eric Larson's a great example of that too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he has a wonderful thing that he does, and he did it in particular. I forget the name of the one about the Blitzkrieg in London and stuff, but he's a great researcher, and everything that was ever said that was interesting about that period, every letter, everything that appeared in a newspaper, and he just strings them one after the other, after the other, after the other, after the other. How can it not be great? In every paragraph is something, and then in this letter, someone said, and then in this newspaper, and it's just an incredible, and it's very engaging and very readable, and it does tell the story.
But it's almost like leaving out the parts that people skip, which is the Elmore Leonard rule.
That was the old Elmore Leonard thing, which I took to heart. I do that.
Right.
I think mostly there's somebody wandering behind you. Be careful. Oh
that's
he's
true.
Gone.
Yeah. He's going to take me out here.
He went past.
There's that real clunky thing that some writers employ in nonfiction where it's like, Jim must've been thinking about his upcoming vacation, you know, that kind of filler that they put in.
Well, the worst thing to me is, and it happens in fiction a lot too, is you can tell somebody's researched it and now they're going to dump 10 pages of research. you know, like in the middle of this, what's supposed to be a very dramatic chapter, but all of a sudden you're going to find out everything in the world about St. Patrick's Cathedral, where a murder is going to take place. And it's taking place and the guns are out. But now you're going to find out about all the architecture. And you know, there it comes. Here comes all the research.
Was fabulous. Yeah. Just stop the story cold in its tracks.
But that was the trick with the Crichton, you know, with and I did a lot of research, and I had a wonderful researcher on volcanoes in Alaska, of all places, Elizabeth from Alaska. And then the trick is, you know, how to use this without slowing the story down.
Yeah. Right. There are a couple of good comments here about what we were talking about. It says, someone suggested that the parent requesting the ban on a book should be made to read the book aloud to the headmaster of the school before they can ask for it to be banned.
Yeah, stuff like that. Well, and look, I mean, the parents, you know, you're home, the kid, you have a right to ask the kid what book you're reading. What do you think? How do you feel about it? Is it scaring you? Is it disturbing you? Well, let's talk about that. That's a parent's, and parents should do that. You know, they're going to decide what movies you go to. Are they, you know, unfortunately, well, I mean, the screen team, the time is tricky now. You know, what's on your computer? You know, so it's really hard to cut kids off completely. But I understand. I mean, there's some appropriateness. And at what point are you going to talk about certain things with the kid? Is the kid mature enough at 7 or whatever? And, you know, I think that so there's obviously there's some stuff there that needs to be a lot of it. You know, the parents have rights too, you know, within reason. But that doesn't mean that we're going to ban Maya Angelou or whatever, you know,
right.
Toni Morrison. She seems to be a real target.
Really?
Wow. But I mean,
big time.
Yeah, she really is.
Because she's writing about that it was a tough time for the slaves. Oh my God. Woo! Amazing. hard times back there, you know. Yeah.
Wow.
But what's actually happening is, well, a parent is entitled to make decisions for their own children. I don't think they're entitled to make decisions for other people's children. And that's really the nub.
That's where people get in trouble with the extreme left and extreme right, because they want to make decisions for everybody.
Exactly.
What about raising the bar for kids? I mean, you know.
Oh, man, the bar is getting lowered. So it's just, it's ridiculous. It's really, and I don't know what's going to happen to the country ultimately. In terms of people digging deep and being able to think and
taking
responsibility.
Thinking.
And taking responsibility for your actions.
Yeah, but
no, education, you did this. Health.
There we are.
I'm sorry.
I talked over you. My apologies. I was saying if the education system fails us, then, you know, then, and there's no critical thinking being taught or whatever, then, you know, then we get nothing but followers and no leaders.
Yeah.
We need George Carlin back with us right about now. He was so spot on.
Comedians, I mean, that's a tough business. Boy, how do you be a comedian? Because, you know, you can't talk about anything. Very difficult. I can't imagine. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anything else, Patrick?
Let's see here.
Are we winding up?
Well, Brendan Dubois is watching.
Oh, hi, Brendan.
Oh, really? Did I say nice things about him? I take it all back.
I said,
and his wife too. She's terrible. They're both terrible people.
And all the nice things I said.
I hope the snow is morning. I hope the snow is finally off the roof of their house and stuff. But you know,
I think that's about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you, Jim. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. This is great.
I always
and I hope. Yeah. Brenda had nothing to do with this, but I decided to put his name on the cover anyway.
Oh,
you know, what the heck? He's a nice man, you know.
Anyway.
Thank you, Barbara. No, actually, he's an unbelievably good writer. He's a very, very good writer, good thinker, good person to work with.
I think this is just a fabulous book to read for June. Great book for Father's Day because, as I've said all the way through, really entertaining, really a fast read. But boy, there are some really serious issues and underneath all that. And really worth discussing. I mean, this could even be a really good book discussion club, you know, book discussion.
Yeah. Thank you. That's good. Yeah.
Yep. Anyway, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Patrick. Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brendan. Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.